I'm Julie Burstein here on this sunny Thursday afternoon in for Leonard Lopate. If you grew up on Mighty Mouse or Heckle and Jekyll on Saturday mornings, or perhaps later you snuck in to see the once X-rated Fritz the Cat, you've seen the animation of Ralph Bakshi. His work paved the way for The Simpsons and South Park and influenced other filmmakers such as Quentin Tarantino, Spike Lee, and Peter Jackson. Now the first book detailing his career has just been published. It's called Unfiltered, The Complete Ralph Bakshi by John M. Gibson and Chris McDonald from Universe. And I'm pleased that it brings Mr. Bakshi to the Leonard Lopate Show. Welcome.
Hi. Hello. Hi.
So you have traveled long distances both in your imagination and physically. You were born in Haifa, Israel. What brought your parents there?
Bullets. Lots of bullets. My parents, basically, my father left Russia during the revolution and came to Palestine in those days as a young boy of 14 with his family.
Wow.
And met my mother there, who also escaped from Hitler and went to Palestine. They got married. And then when the war started again, well, basically, my father got in trouble with the British. He was part of the Irgun, and he thought it best if he left or came to America, to tell you the truth. So,
well, when
that's the real story.
When you start talking, I think people know that you didn't grow up in Palestine and Israel. You grew up here in Brooklyn.
Brownsville. Yeah, we came to Brownsville straight from Palestine to a cold water flat on Bristol and Pitkin, which was where we all grew up, in three rooms. Yeah.
What drew you to animation? What was the beginning of that?
First of all, World War II, America, the comic books. I mean, I grew up, and the first thing that really impressed me were the comic books. And we all read comic books. They were very important to us. And I didn't realize that they were drawn by people, that they were something you could do for a living. I used to somehow think they were real. I never considered the fact that people earned a living drawing comic
making
books.
These, yes.
Making it, these. Yeah. And I was stunned when I finally realized that it was. I wasn't necessarily drawn to animation. I love comic strips, comic books. I wanted to be another Al Cap.
Uh-huh.
In those days, newspapers were huge. Comic strips were huge. And I just had a passion for comic strips. And I studied comics in the High School of Industrial Arts. I basically left my academic world to go and become a cartoonist.
So they let you study comics in
high school?
There
was this one school in Manhattan called the High School of Industrial Arts. It was a vocational school. It was in the days when vocational schools really helped kids who weren't going to college out. That's all gone with, I hear. Now you go to college or you're doomed. You go to college and you pay for the rest of your life. Anyway, you're doomed. The point was, there were vocational schools where if you were interested in becoming a dental mechanic or an auto mechanic or a comic strip artist.
Or a comic strip. That's wonderful that was listed as one of the trades you could go into.
It was listed as a trade. And basically what was great about the school was up on 79th Street, so it got me to Manhattan out of Brooklyn. And we went from 8 to 5. That was a long high school day. And I had comic strip drawing from my teacher, Charles Allen. And he was a wonderful, wonderful teacher. He was a black cartoonist. In those days, he had a problem getting jobs. So I learned a lot about what the world was like from Charles. He was a brilliant cartoonist. And when I left high school, the thing was to get a job. Because how else do you take girls out? You need a job. We used to take them to movies. So I took a job at an animation company at Terrytoons and fell in love with animation.
Your first or one of your jobs there was something called a cell polisher.
Yes.
What is a cell polisher?
Before in the old days, before computers, cells went to cameras, and the cells had to be clean. Cells were what the animation was on.
And it was it done on a piece of paper, the way of drawing? It was plastic.
Plastic, and you could see through the cell except where the character was, and the background would come through the cell.
Ah.
And basically, you had to polish the dust and the dirt off the cell, or it would be shot, and the animation would start to jump. It was an impossible job. You ever try to take, because the cells produce a lot of static, and you're sitting there wiping all day, trying to get the dust off, and my mother tried to have me clean the kitchen, you know, the dishes sometimes. I couldn't do that well either. So I had a miserable time there. Miserable.
When did you get to start drawing things?
Not for a while. Yeah.
It was it like an apprenticeship system where you had to go through all of the really cruddy jobs to
Yes, if you could survive the cell thing, they figured you stood a chance. So the next job was to paint the cells themselves. That was the next step up, and that was $55 a week. And that was a lot of money in those days. That was decent. And then you painted the cells for about a couple of years. I just sat there painting cells.
Someone else would have inked the drawing, exactly. And then you would say, all right, here's where the blue goes. And
someone would tell me this is where the blue goes. They didn't trust me to pick it. Someone else said, put the blue here, Ralph. Yes.
When did you get a chance to come up with some ideas yourself?
Well, it's an extraordinary story. I did that for a bunch of years, and then basically the studio itself, CBS, the television station, had just bought Terry Toons. And Terry Toons, which wasn't doing that well, because television was buying animation, but no one was buying Terry Toons animation. So the boss, Bill Weiss, hired a lot of great cartoonists. Blackman, Jules Pfeiffer, Harvey Kurtzman. A lot of geniuses came in to write and produce shows to sell to Fred Silverman at CBS.
And the kinds of shows that we might have remembered from those days, from Terry Toons, I know Mighty Mouse was one.
Well, Tom Terrific, which was the first, which was a quiche, and that was Captain Kangaroo, produced the first animated show called Tom Terrific. And that was terrific.
Yeah, I remember that.
It was terrific. But for some reason, CBS never bought any more. So what happened was I had to carry all this artwork down to CBS. I was just a lowly kid. And I put all the artwork around the world, the room, and all these guys, these big shots, pitched shows to Fred Silver, and he turned every one of them down. And the room got deathly quiet, and every executive was in the room because CBS had bought Terry Toons, and the boss was demanding that CBS buy something from them and not Hanna-Barbera. But Fred could not find anything he liked for CBS. And somehow, because I felt guilty. It felt like it was my fault. I mean, I didn't have anything to do with the presentation.
Except for schlepping all this stuff
down. I felt guilty, so I stood up as the meeting was ending, and Fred was standing, and this is a true story. And I said, I have an idea. And the whole room looked at me, and Fred sat down and said, what is it? And I didn't have an idea, except I had to create one fast. And I created an idea called The Mighty Heroes. Which was not a big deal, really, to me, because you've picked five superheroes, all have different abilities, and they're all stupid.
Diaper Man, favorite, with a voice like this.
Yeah. Well, you see, I was married at 19 and had a kid at 20, and that was my kid. He used to get up in the morning. We all lived in the same room. He used to get up in the morning when he wanted milk in his crib and throw his bottle at me. Throw it at me. Hit me in the head. I know what it needed. These are true stories. So he had a diaper or something. And Fred Silver says, I love it.
Oh my goodness.
And the place went crazy. By the time I got back to Terry Toons, it was like I was Bobby Thompson. It's like I hit a home run to beat the Dodgers in the ninth inning of the World Series with two outs. People were pounding me on but I saved the studios.
And there was you had no images. You had
nothing.
No story. You just said, we should have Brooklyn hype.
Store hype. Nothing. Just my mouth. You know, but I had read a lot of comics. Behind the mouth was a history of reading this stuff. It wasn't like I was ignorant. You know.
And there was also this wonderful kind of satirical look at all of the superheroes that we'd all ingested who were all so incredibly brave. But here you have Cuckoo Man and Diaper Man.
Well, that obviously was always my thing. I still get my daughter mad. She said, can't you ever be nice to anybody? I mean, the point is that I look at things a certain way, and that's the way I like to look at it. But, of course, Bill Malden, one of my favorite cartoonists who taught me a lot. I'm not taking credit for everything. When I was a young man in high school, Bill Malden, who wrote Willie and Joe for the Stars and Stripes in World War II, was absolutely brilliant. His war stuff, his Willie and Joe were the greatest things ever done. He showed me that cartoons could be adult. He showed me cartoons could make sense. He covered the war so wonderful. Many years later, I was going to do Willie and Joe. I met him. I wanted to meet him, so I called him when I had a big studio and I was a big shot. And I wanted to do Willie and Joe for television, and we ran around. I wanted to do a Christmas special with Malden. I mean, I was the happiest guy in the world, and no one knew who he was. Nobody knew who he was, and I got into fights with television people who didn't know who he was. I said, how dare you not know who Bill Malden was? And he understood that because he already had gotten involved with that sort of thing in his own newspaper. So we never sold it. No one wanted Willie and Joe. And I still think it's a great animation idea.
I'm speaking with Ralph Bakshi.
Willie and Joe, World War II, could you imagine?
And you, Ralph Bakshi, you've done so many different things, including World War II. There's in American Pop, there's
right.
an amazing scene of a young pianist who's decided to go to war against the wishes of his family and who ends up playing piano in a decrepit, bombed out house. That's just.
I love that scene.
And it's.
And the Nazis kill him.
And the Nazis.
First, they say thank you first.
Yes, first he says thank you, and then he kills him. He changes the music to something. I don't know what he plays in the scene.
Lily Marlene, a very big German song.
And in watching that scene, I realized in a lot of what you do,
thank you.
Music matters so much. Music really propels what you do.
Music is what life's about. Music is so important. Music is what we think about. It propels us. It lives with us. Classic, good music. Of course, what you consider good music is personal. We are all about music, and people who try to not understand that don't understand what film's about. What would The Godfather be without The Godfather theme? Much less, what would Scarborough Fair be? The Graduate, what would it be without Simon and Garfunkel? Music is so important to what America is about. It certainly describes who we were at the time. When you listen to Frank Sinatra and Dorsey today, I heard him the other day, I can't get enough of young Sinatra. You want to hear a great singer?
Who also expresses the feeling of a particular time, as you're saying.
Nails it.
Yeah.
Has no choice. We are part of. You see, if you are of a particular time, it's music that is written at that time that expresses it, you know, and stays forever honest to that time. Lately, music has gotten perverted by suits in studios who think they know what they're doing and so calculated that the whole music industry has collapsed because they don't allow the musicians to express their times. The 60s and the 70s were the last time musicians expressed what the times were about because the boys weren't telling them how to write it or do it.
Do you feel your work, too? I mean, I think you're talking about the 60s and 70s. In the early 70s, you created the first X-rated animation, Fritz the Cat.
Yes, I did.
Do you feel that came out of that time, too?
Absolutely.
That was something that...
Well, it came out a little time before. You know, one of the things I've told when I shoot live-action movies is, look, guys, we're doing a 40s film, but please put 1920 cars and 1930 cars in the street. You know, you can't be in a period where you can't get the older stuff. No one goes into the 1940s and every car in the street is 1940s. You have to put 1930 cars in, but that's the way it is. So,
because people actually hold on to that stuff. It's not like in 1945, we're all buying new 1945 cars. Yeah,
so why I bring that up is because the 50s, leading into the early 60s, is what produced it. In other words, Jackson Pollock, Miles Davis, the New York School of Painting, all of that freedom, and rock and roll, Elvis. I mean, believe it, all of that freedom and freedom of expression that really started in the 50s led into allowing the underground, the cartoon underground, to be born. But it wasn't born out of nothing. It was born out of Pollock, Miles Davis, John Coltrane, The Village, all the things that were happening in America, honestly, the guys coming home from World War II that had fought for us and now didn't have anything to do. I mean, I remember those guys hanging around the corner in their uniforms when they came home from World War II because they didn't know where to go. And they used to talk to each other. And then one day they all disappeared because people didn't want them around anymore. They reminded them of a different time. But that reality is what led to the breakthrough, you know, in the 60s and 70s of what I did. It wasn't any magic. It was the honesty of expression that we had then is so different than the dishonesty of expression in so many areas we have now. We can get into that if you want.
Well, we only have, actually, I'm looking at the time, we only have a couple of minutes.
I can go on for hours about what's going on.
Well, I know you're going to have opportunities here in New York to
Obama,
talk to people. But I wanted to ask you, you've taken, and that's that. You can talk about that on at Comic-Con in a couple of days. But
I had to throw that in, you know.
You have, in the past couple of years, focused on painting.
Yes, I have.
And was that partly because the heavy lift of getting things done with the systems Made it.
Perfect. I'm having a show tonight in the amazing gallery, so come down and see my paintings. I didn't want those guys to push me around. I didn't want to work for those guys. I didn't want to take orders. I don't want to sell out. I want to get up every day and do a painting or a drawing. That's all I'm about. And the minute it got rough for me in Hollywood and these guys were telling me what to do, I said, who needs you? I can get up and paint and draw every day and no one could tell me what to do or what to paint. Because the cost of the paintbrushes and the cost of the canvases don't cost anything. And I could be an artist and ha-ha on you. So I love painting and drawing. It's part of what I was doing in animation. I feel no different doing that than doing my films. But I really wasn't going to go for the big bread, you know, to make the kind of commercial films they wanted me to make. So I just turned around and left. I live on a hill now looking at Mexico.
Oh, how lovely.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
Well, Ralph Bakshi, it's been a pleasure to talk to you about your work. And
thank you.
If people do want to see your paintings, you can go to the, is it the Animazing Gallery in Soho?
You're yes, going it's to be on Broome Street.
Speaking yeah. tonight at 6, yeah. and you'll also be talking tomorrow at the New York Comic Con. And speaking and signing books Saturday at screenings of your films at the Anthology Film Archives. For details about all of these, you can go to our show page at WNYC.org. Ralph Bakshi, thank you so much.
Well, thanks for remembering that American pop scene is my favorite. Well, thank you.